Good morning, everyone. We have a lifetime of dim in here right now, but we will be bringing them up as part of the service. I would invite everyone to move forward. We're going to probably keep the lights off in the back. So if you come to about at least the mid-level here, you'll get better lighting when we do bring up the lights. So I have a number of announcements today, in part because you can't read your order of service. This first one combines both the past and the future. So see if you can parse this statement. 3 years ago, tomorrow, our solar electric panels began turning out electrical power with a forecast of producing 25,000 kilowatt hours of electricity and generating some $3,000 a year for LCUUC in buyback from We Energies. The panels and sun have colluded as we expected them to, and so come by the social hall after the service and celebrate with sunshine cake and solar tea. Please do not stare directly into the sunshine cakes. Today at 6:30 in the sanctuary right here at LCUUC, in cooperation with Physicians for a National Health Plan, we will be presenting a screening of the video, The Waiting Room, with discussion to follow. So I ask everyone to come and enjoy and join in the discussion. Next up, the Kintsugi Sangha Meditation Group, which meets on Thursdays outdoors next to the garden, if the weather is good, and in the sanctuary if it is not, will be hosting a guest speaker this week. John Nemec, Vimala Roshi, is an acknowledged Zen master and Dharma heir to Abbot Junpo Dennis Kelly of the Hollow Bones Rinzai Zen Order. He leads Zen practice with the Green Tara Sangha in Green Bay. Vimalan has offered many presentations on Zen and aspects of the Buddhist tradition to both practitioners and lay audiences. This Thursday, he will lead conversation about dukkha, or stuckness, as addressed through traditional Buddhist teachings. If this will be your first visit on to the meditation group, please arrive closer to 6 o'clock so that you have time to settle in and be ready to begin at 6:30. And those meetings conclude by 8:15. So that's on Thursdays. When you came in today, you should have picked up an order of service and a hollow bone sutra. So if you did not get one, we'll bring some around. The Hollow Bone Sutra has some readings that we'll be joining in with, so make sure you have that. It's a large booklet. You are also welcome to keep this, take it home with you, and use it, enjoy it, and come to the Thursdays to learn more about the sutras and the meditations contained therein. Some of you may have noticed, or hopefully all of you noticed as you came in, that there's some construction going on. So Will Norris and crew have made great progress on our ADA restroom, and more help is needed this week. So if you have some time that you can dedicate to this, please sign up to help on the sign-up sheet in the social hall. And that's if you're willing and able. And I hope some more people come along and help with that. And last, our speaker today is Eric Moraine. Eric Moraine is an LCUUC hallway lurker and coffee slurper, going back to the days of Sunday evening services in Wales. Confused, as most teenagers were, one day he tripped over Taoism in junior high school, but he managed to stand up, dust himself off, and hurry on as though nothing had happened. His ever-curious nature led to his revisiting that accident, and eventually led to his ordination as a Rinzai Zen Buddhist priest. A student of Roshi Maru Danda and his teacher Junpo, and his teacher's teacher, Aido Shimano Roshi, Eric facilitates the LCUUC Thursday Zen Studies Group, the Kintsugi Sangha, which is evolving into an ongoing community underneath the LCUUC umbrella. So, welcome all. Jim, you can turn off the lights. Thank you. Unitarian Universalist Church. At LCUUC, we strive to surround this community with the spirit of love in everything we do. My name is Paul Backler, and I'm the worship associate for this morning's service. As a welcoming congregation, we hope that all visitors, wherever they are on life's journey, and whatever their backgrounds, will find a lasting home here. No matter who you love, or what pronouns you use to describe yourself, you are welcome here. Please join us for refreshments and conversation after the service in the social hall. And while you're there, stop by our welcome table to find out more about LCUUC. Today's order of service includes announcements of upcoming church activities, and we look forward to all our visitors and friends and members joining in. Please take a moment at this point in the service to silence all electronics you may have brought with you here today. And again, welcome to all here this morning. We are so pleased that you have chosen to celebrate and worship with us. And take a moment to greet your neighbors sitting around you. In the old Buddhist tradition, when you took vows, you gave away all your worldly possessions, owning nothing but the rags you wore and the begging bowl you set out for food. You never charged for what you did, and you accumulated no worldly possessions. This didn't work well for those who had a vision of a long-term structure and stability. Thus was born the concept of dana, a free will offering made to acknowledge the fact that something of value has just been transferred. Dana is not payment, nor is it a fee for services rendered. It is a monetary recognition that this information or event has value and is worthy of continuing. As with the laws of physics, the karmic equations always balance, no exceptions. If you give nothing, eventually you'll get nothing. What doesn't get support crashes to the ground. As we pass the collection basket this morning, keep in mind what you value in this community and consider a dana offering for what you have found here that you wish to continue. This morning's offering will now be gratefully given and received. Service when we share our joys and concerns. We do this in two ways, by speaking them aloud and by lighting candles. If you have a joy or concern you wish to share, please raise your hand and an usher will bring you a microphone. Please briefly introduce yourself and tell us your joy or concern.
Good morning, I'm Tracy. Please light two candles for me for my brother's family. The first is one of incredible joy, and I am just so proud of my brother. He has MS and has been struggling with that for years, to the point where it's very difficult for him to walk. And last weekend he did the MS bike ride and managed to just about finish the first half, but the bike ride allowed him to finish, cross the finish line at the first half and then also cross the finish line at the end. So it was just an amazing, amazing thing that he could do that. And the other candle is for my sister-in-law, who has struggled and had breast cancer with a recurrence and now has metastases that are in her bones. And so they've got a lot going on these days. So keep them in your, there, keep them in your thoughts, please.
I'm Carrie, and please light a candle of joy for the service trip that we took with our youth a week ago. We were at a farm in Minnesota, and it was really an inspiring group of young people working with permaculture and restoration agriculture and living lives committed to social justice. And I think our kids had a great experience, and it was a joyful event.
I'm Joanne, and a candle of joy because Sam is home from her trip to Paraguay.
Hi, my name is Esther. My family always, being very large, we have started maybe 4 or 5 years ago, taking turns going to those of us that live in the Midwest anyway, having a summer outing at our each other's homes. And anyway, Tuesday was my day, last Tuesday, and 8 of us were able to be there with our husbands and wives. And so most of us are in relatively good health, and the ages were anywhere from, my youngest brother was there, and he's 60, and the oldest one is 82 at this time. So there were 8 of us there. Two were not able to. So light a candle of joy. One more thing. The weather cooperated beautifully on Tuesday after a day of rain on Monday.
Please light a candle of concern and joy. Our daughter Maya passed her driver's test this week. And so now we have the joy of seeing her take flight, but also have the concern that every time she leaves the house in the car that we are worried.
And my name is Jim. If you'd light a candle for the joy that was felt at the Kirtan here on Friday featuring fire dancers.
Good morning. My name is Ellen. I'm visiting here from Santa Monica, California. And we're all gathered at my sister's home on Beaver Lake. So if you wouldn't mind lighting a candle of joy for our gathering there, although it is bittersweet because we did lose my sister in April. But fortunately, family members are gathered there and we're celebrating her life.
And I will light one final candle for the joys and concerns we keep in our hearts.
The first reading for today is from Thich Nhat Hanh. It's called Call Me By My True Names. Do not say that I'll depart tomorrow, because even today I arrive. Look deeply. I arrive in every second to be a bud on a spring branch, to be a tiny bird with wings still fragile, learning to sing in my new nest, to be a caterpillar in the heart of a flower, to be a jewel hiding itself in a stone. I still arrive in order to laugh and to cry, in order to fear and to hope. The rhythm of my heart is the birth and death of all that are alive. I am the mayflower, the mayfly metamorphosing on the surface of a river, and I am the bird which, when spring comes, arrives in time to eat the mayfly. I am the frog swimming happily in the clear pond, and I'm also the grass snake who, approaching in silence, feeds itself on the frog. I am the child in Uganda, all skin and bones, with legs as thin as bamboo sticks. And I am the arms merchant, selling deadly weapons to Uganda. I am the 12-year-old girl, refugee on a small boat, who throws herself into the ocean after being raped by a sea pirate. And I am the pirate, my heart not yet capable of seeing and loving. I am a member of the Politburo with plenty of power in my hands. And I am the man who has to pay his debt of blood to my people, dying slowly in a forced labor camp. My joy is like spring, so warm it makes flowers bloom in all walks of life. My pain is like a river of tears, so full it fills the four oceans. Please call me by my true names, so I can hear all the cries and laughter at once, so I can see that my joy and my pain are one. Please call me by my true names, so I can wake up, so the door of my heart can be left open, the door of compassion.
So join me in a few moments of silence and a little bit of meditation. Some people claim they've tried meditating and they can't. That's like saying you can't exercise, that you tried it, but you can't exercise. Well, I'd believe you if you said you couldn't do 100 sit-ups, but I don't know if I believe that you can't exercise at all. So this morning, join me in some silence and just notice what's going on around you. Zen meditation is about becoming aware. It's about waking up. It's not about shutting down and disconnecting. Listen to the silence around you. Just notice what you see. Notice what you smell. No need to judge it. No need to interpret it. No need to make lists. Just be present.
So the second reading
page 39 in the Sutra Books. It's called Song of Zazen. And it's traditionally recited before every Dharma talk. Dharma just means teaching. And the reason it's always recited before every Dharma talk is that way back when, they decided this pretty much contains everything that needs to be said. Anything else is icing on the cake. So whatever prattling you're going to hear after the Song of Zazen might just distort and confuse what is a pretty clear message.
Song of Zazen.
And recite this with me if you'd like. Sentient beings are, from the very beginning, Buddhas. It is like ice and water. Apart from water, no ice can exist. Outside sentient beings, where do we find the Buddhas? Not knowing how near the truth is, we seek it far away. What a pity. We are like a child in the midst of water, who cries out in thirst so imploringly. We are like the child of a rich house who has wandered away among the poor. The cause of our circling through the six worlds is that we are on the dark paths of ignorance, going astray further and further in the darkness. When are we able to be free from birth and death? As for Zazen practice of the Mahayana, it is beyond all our praise. The virtues of perfection, such as charity, morality, and the invocation of the Buddha's name, confession and ascetic discipline, and many other good deeds of merit, all these return to this. Even those who have practiced meditation for just one sitting will see all their twisted karma erased. Nowhere will they find twisted paths, but the pure land will be near at hand. With a reverent heart, if we listen to this truth, even once, and gladly embrace it, we will surely be blessed most infinitely. If we concentrate within and testify to the truth that self-nature is no nature, we have really gone beyond vain words. The gate of the oneness of cause and effect is open. The path of non-duality and true clarity runs straight ahead. To regard the form of no form as form, whether going or returning, we cannot be anyplace else. To regard the thought of no thought as thought, whether singing or dancing, we are the voice of the Dharma. How boundless the clear sky of Samadhi. How transparent the perfect moonlight of the fourfold wisdom. At this moment, what more need we see? As this truth eternally reveals itself, this very place is the lotus paradise. This very body is the Buddha. Tradition that stretches back 2,500 years to the teachings offered by Siddhartha Gautama, born about 563 BC. The teachings of that person who, in a fit of stubborn frustration, one day sat down under a Bodhi tree and declared, "I will not get up until I wake up." The teachings of that Buddha made a lasting impression. Buddhism, currently being the fourth largest religion in the world. During the Buddha's lifetime, he made it abundantly clear that his was a philosophy of living and not a religion of worship or devotion. Over the centuries, his followers mostly reverted back to what they were familiar with, which was a religion and not a philosophy. But his teachings and their various local interpretations migrated north out of India to Tibet, eventually east to China, farther east to Japan, and then even farther east to California, and more recently, east to Heartland, Wisconsin, of all places. Who would have guessed such a thing was possible? So as these teachings met with indigenous local beliefs, they were influenced by and changed as a result of a blending with what was already established in that region. Even today, Buddhism is a work in progress. Change is constant. The Dalai Lama was asked, "How does Buddhism relate to modern science?" His answer was, "If science proves some belief of Buddhism wrong, then Buddhism will have to change." In my view, science and Buddhism share a search for the truth and a desire to understand reality. So today we study science, sometimes by memorizing formulas and developing mnemonic aids to better remember the important concepts. E equals I over R, P1 over V1 equals P2 over V2. Big boys race our young girls, but violent generally wins. That last one is a mnemonic device to help remember the color codes of resistors for electronic circuits. Black, brown, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, violet, gray, white was hard for me to memorize as what seemed to be a random string of words. But when it was put together as a funny sentence, it was easier to remember for the tests and electronic shop at school. Buddhism took a similar approach to teaching. For many centuries, the primary audience were rural folk who had never been to a school, much less read a book. This was a bit of a dilemma because the goal of the instruction was to teach about subtle states of mind and how to contend with the human ego so as to awaken and become a Buddha. The solution was to create mnemonic aids to help memorize and in that way pass along crucial information from one generation to the next, and to do it orally. And thus were created the three marks of existence, the four noble truths, the five hindrances, the eightfold path, the ten perfections, and many, many more numerical dharma lists, or teaching lists. These were the ancient equivalent of stop, drop, and roll. Most every grade school child can tell you what to do if you're walking along and your clothes happen to catch on fire by accident. Stop, drop, and roll. It's simple, easy to remember. Buddhist dharma lists were developed as a means of teaching subtle and oftentimes confusing philosophical concepts to people who for the most part couldn't read and understood relatively little about their own internal psychological workings. With a dharma list to memorize, they could at least hold on to what was important. Hopefully, in time, they would learn why these things were important, and eventually, maybe, grasp the more subtle lessons therein. I learned what the Four Noble Truths were about 20 years ago, but I didn't really understand them. In another 20 years, maybe I will. And in the meantime, I can pass along the mnemonic list of the Four Noble Truths so we can all recite them together and discuss or maybe argue back and forth about what they might really mean. In this way, Buddhism, Unitarianism, and quantum physics are identical. Put three of any of these folks together and you'll likely get four answers, regardless of what your question is. Today I want to share one of these mnemonic devices, the three klishas. That Pali word, klisha, is sometimes translated as mental poison or emotional perversion, also sometimes described as a thought defilement or distortion. Personally, I prefer the word poison. The three poisons are translated as greed, aversion, and ignorance, or lust, hatred, and ignorance, also sometimes delusion, anger, and foolishness. But the descriptive that seems most common is ignorance, which is generally recognized as the root cause of all the other klishas. One could say ignorance is the primary or active ingredient in a variety of mental poisons. I'm going to say, for the sake of this morning, I'm going to say that ignorance comes in two flavors, traditional Buddhist or modern secular. The traditional ignorance, which Buddhists refer to as a misunderstanding or lack of awareness regarding the deeper, subtler meaning of the Four Noble Truths, which are: suffering exists, there's a cause for this suffering, The cause is stuck thinking, and the way to end the suffering is to follow and understand the Eightfold Path. And I'm not going to go into that part this morning. In the traditional sense, ignorance speaks to a lack of understanding regarding the fundamental nature of human existence. A modern description of these Four Noble Truths might be something like, crappy things happen and life stinks. Life stinks because we get stuck on wanting things, ideas, ways of living. And even though life stinks and then you die, there is something you can do about this stinkiness while you're alive. And what you need to do is pay attention to 8 simple rules of living, and the crappiness of life will stop. A modern, secular definition of ignorance might be something like a state of being uninformed, lacking knowledge. Ignorance is often used as an insult to describe individuals who deliberately ignore or disregard important information or facts. Drill, baby, drill. Shoot first, ask questions later. The solution to modern ignorance often appears to be get more information, become informed, have better data, know your history, do the due diligence. Just so we're clear here, none of us in this room this morning are ignorant. You know, it's the other folks out there. Those are the ones that are the problem. I mean, you know the kind, you know, the ones who listen to the wrong podcasts, the folks who read the wrong websites and vote for candidates with the wrong color of campaign poster. The ignorant folk, you know, the ones who are driving the world off the cliff and destroying everything we hold near and dear. I mean, really, how is it possible that these ignorant, bleeding, left-wing, liberal socialists who tax like there's no tomorrow can't see how nearsighted they are? How is it possible that these ignorant, conservative, gun-toting, border-closing, fiscal tightwads who want to drown in a bathtub all that made this country great can't see how nearsighted they are? So what's a person to do? How do we live with each other without strangling each other? What's the answer? Become more informed? Campaign harder? Donate more? Argue longer? Argue louder? Take hostages? And what if we could force those ignorant troublemakers to see it our way, the correct way, the one true and only right way? Then we might finally get things straightened up and flying right again. I mean, the end does justify the means in a desperate situation like this, don't you agree? I mean, we are kind of facing end times here now, aren't we? Actually, I don't think the end justifies the means, and I don't think the solution is more information. I mean, heck, I have almost the entirety of humanity's information right here in my hand, and what good has this done me? I use it mostly to argue with strangers I'll never meet and share videos of cats doing silly things. Intelligence and information are not the opposite of, nor are they the antidote to ignorance. If they were, ignorance would have ceased to exist long ago, maybe shortly after Gutenberg destroyed the scribe industry with his printing press. I think there are still plenty of ignorant people around, even though we are drowning today in a sea of information. And in spite of that information overload, ignorance, either traditional Buddhist or secular modern, as a powerful influence of human behavior has not ended. Not that those ignorant people are here in this room. Yeah, they do exist, but not in this church. I mean, not here. I'm just saying, you know, ignorant folks are around in a sort of a general kind of way, sort of. You know. Is it getting warm here? I'd say the near enemy of ignorance is stupidity. A near enemy being that which can masquerade as the object in question, but is not the object in question. Stupidity is a lack of mental ignorance, of mental intelligence, the potential for which is predetermined and mostly genetically determined. You can't really study harder and raise your IQ score by more than a few points. As I read on a crude bumper sticker once, you can't fix stupid. Fortunately, there are really very few people who are actually, truly, mentally stupid in the non-pejorative sense of the word. Most of our foolish actions and choices are driven not by authentic mental stupidity, but rather by ignorance of the subject or situation at hand. That being said, for the most part, we tend to believe and act in a way that demonstrates we think we know more than we actually do. Our reach tends to exceed our grasp. This becomes particularly apparent as you wrestle with larger, more complex issues like poverty, war, and global economics. A little knowledge is a dangerous thing, Alexander Pope, 1688, and I dare say that still applies today. So is there an antidote to this closed-minded, overreaching, I've-got-it-figured-out self-righteousness? Does it matter whether it's really politically red or blue, religiously free will Baptist or Eastern Orthodox, environmentally Prius or Hummer, nutritionally vegan or Atkins, medicinally allopathic or homeopathic, neighborly Palestinian or Israeli? What does it take to deepen understanding and insight? What would it take to cultivate genuine tolerance, curiosity, and gentle, insightful, reasoned inquiry? How do we stop the wars? Can't we all just get along? At some level, we're all like zombies, tromping ahead, wanting brains, more brains, as if more brains and more information will change us, when in fact we're still mostly numb, dead on the inside, and really in need of a wiser heart, not a more intelligent brain. In these modern times, wisdom as a life goal seems to have been mostly replaced with a desire for the accumulation of information, which presents itself as intelligence. If the near enemy of ignorance is stupidity, well, what then is the far enemy? What is the opposite of ignorance? The antidote to the poison of ignorance is intelligence, really? Well, if so, then why doesn't IQ seem to make much of a difference? There are a lot of really, really smart politicians out there. It also takes intelligence to make the money to buy a Hummer or a Prius, to vacation to Wally World or the Costa Rican rainforest. I'd suggest that ignorance and intelligence are made of the same stuff. A sort of a self-assured, self-centered confidence that what you're doing is the right thing to do, which may include or infer a possible lack of genuine, deeper connection. A lack of true subtle insight about the complex interrelatedness of all things. I believe we are living inside the butterfly effect every minute of every day. Wisdom, which might shine light on that mind-bogglingly complex interrelatedness and interdependence of the allness of everything, is what's really needed, not a faster smartphone. Wisdom suggests a subtle understanding of the subject at hand. Webster says, wisdom is the mastery of seeing from within, often attained through age, but not always by education. Wisdom is the outward manifestation of an inward quality. Lee Van Laer says, for every right action to be possible, every active must begin as a contemplative. Think about that. To manifest wisdom, every action you take must begin as an internally contemplated mental event. That sort of sounds like think before you act. I think I heard that from my mother. Wisdom differs from intelligence in that it includes a compassionate, emotive quality. Intelligence alone can be dry or cutting, even arrogant and sometimes dismissive. But wisdom evokes images of a white-haired grandmother stirring a pot of applesauce on the stove and gently, lovingly offering words to her despondent teenage grandson sitting at the kitchen table, heartbroken, devastated after his first real girlfriend broke up with him. Wisdom is a grandfather ankle-deep in wood shavings out in the shop behind the house, sharing morning coffee with his soon-to-be daughter-in-law and talking about the challenges of a surprise pregnancy. These sorts of conversations don't require dry, arm's-length intelligence or a New York Times bestseller book recommendation. They beg for openness, open-heartedness, depth of character, insight into the messiness of human life, experience, compassion, common sense, discernment. Discernment about what to say and, more importantly, what not to say, when to talk and when to just be quiet. They require a steadfast, unwavering internal strength, a certain psychic rootedness, an ability to hold complexity and to do so compassionately, without judgment. In short, they require wisdom. And fortunately, I found what might be instructions for how to become wise. Live one day at a time. Enjoy one moment at a time. Accept the hardships as the pathway to peace. Accept this wretched world as it is, not as you would want it to be. Trust that it will all end up right in the grand scheme of things if you surrender to the mystery of what comes next. And do this so that you may be reasonably happy in this life. Perhaps this is the antidote to the mental poison of ignorance. Is this a set of instructions for how to become wise? It's actually the second half of the Serenity poem that Reinhold Niebuhr composed. The opening lines may sound a little more familiar. Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. I believe the key to unlocking the door of wisdom in any human is equanimity, that mental stability and composure which is undisturbed by intense emotions, physical pain, or other experiential events that may cause a person to lose their mental balance. An old Zen description of equanimity is, I am moving all day and yet not moving at all. I am like the moon underneath the waves that ever go rolling. Equanimity is the ability to stay upright, unfazed, clear of mind and open-hearted while others all around you are falling apart and losing it. The it they're losing is their equanimity. That unshakable, unmistakable, passionate, unapologetic, non-judgmental, fearless, insightful compassion. This is what it means to be rooted in the Tao. This is clear, deep heart mind. This is speaking from the great mystery. This is being truly awake. This is what the path to enlightenment looks like. And so you might ask, just how could one cultivate equanimity if one wanted to?
How do you do that?
Thanks, John. Because actually, I happen to have another one of those mnemonic devices here to help us out. The four qualities of enlightenment happen to be metta, mudita, upekkha, karuna, which is Sanskrit for loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. So it's easy, sort of. John, just go ahead, wake up, become enlightened. And equanimity, wisdom, compassion, and loving kindness are all yours. And by the way, you become immune to the three poisons as well. You say. Oh, really? You say. It's just that easy, you say? But you say that actually you were willing to settle for a good night's sleep so you could be ready for the Monday morning work schedule craziness. And I'm asking you to become enlightened first so you can go to work feeling rooted, balanced, fair, and double-dipped in equanimity. Well, then you say, I'll get right on that, huh? Yeah. So here's the twist. Don't put the cart before the horse, and it will happen all by itself. If you put effort toward a meditation practice and do your emotional awareness work, and in that way cultivate insight and let go of oversight, you will develop understanding and end your need for overstating. Loving kindness will come naturally. Compassion will replace repression. And soon enough, equanimity will join you as you move your way through the day. You will be moving all day and not moving at all. You will become the moonlight on the waves that ever go gently rolling. So to recap, I propose that wisdom, not intelligence, is the antidote to ignorance and greed and anger. And when you meet them and you engage them from the seat of wisdom rooted in equanimity, what might happen? What would you say? What if before you said anything, you admitted to yourself that little secret hidden agenda of wanting to convert this ignorant person standing in front of you to your way of thinking, which is probably also exactly what they'd like to do to you? What if you acknowledged that these sorts of arm wrestling encounters typically end in a frustrated stalemate? Now what would you do? What if you dropped the conversational agenda and saw the other person for what they are, somewhat ignorant, just like you? What if you admitted to yourself that you have absolutely no control whatsoever about what that other person thinks or does? And if you think you do, I invite you to check that out with any typical four-year-old who will prove to you just how little control you actually have. At the best, you have very limited influence and definitely not any control. What if you met ignorance with rooted, compassionate, fearless wisdom? What if success was not defined as converting someone else's flavor of ignorance to your flavor of ignorance? From your place of wisdom and equanimity, maybe the only thing you could do that would truly be helpful might be a smile and a gentle sigh. And maybe there's more that you'd want to do. Maybe, as a kind, insightful, compassionate, wise person, you'd be brave enough to ask for an invitation to deeper conversation. Or you could just bully your way in the front door with leaflets, bullhorns, and a lot of shaming finger wagging. WWWD, what would wisdom do? Mindfulness practices evoke these qualities of wisdom and equanimity in all of us. I don't understand why this happens, but I know that it does. Don't take my word for it, though. Do not take this or any of what I've said this morning on faith alone. Be a good scientist. Be a good scholar. Be skeptical. Hold on to your inquiring mind, and I do encourage you to try it for yourself, and then see what happens when you meditate regularly for a few weeks or a few months. And then, if you start to see positive changes in yourself, you can say, well, yes, it does appear to work for me, and it might work for you. The equanimity which underpins authentic wisdom as the antidote to the three cliches is within reach of all of us. But only if we're willing to look critically at ourselves. Face yourself in the mirror of self-reflection. Clean up your emotional baggage and become quiet inside on a regular basis. Do this. Do it now. Because this life is not a dress rehearsal for the real event. Don't miss your one opportunity. Do not wait to awaken and realize your true nature. Do your personal work and meditate as if your life depends on it, because it just might. So in this tradition, we've now gotten to the part of the service that the Unitarians call polylog. Click and clack call it stump the chump. And in this Dharma tradition, it's called public mondo. And I'd like to add one new variant to that called LE5. Explain it to me like I'm five. Because if I can't explain it to you like you're five, then maybe I don't really understand it and my ignorance is showing. Yeah, good morning. Yeah, and maybe a microphone. Do we want to do that?
I can talk loud.
Okay.
So basically, it's like this.
I don't have to. So what I'm hearing is, this could possibly fix me and all the ignorant, ridiculous crap that happens to me?
Possibly.
That'd be awesome.
That would be awesome. Yeah. I agree. It's very easy to describe. It's not so easy to do. It's called a practice. It's like exercising, going to the gym. The very hardest part is walking in the front door.
Meditated
with help to get further along. Okay. So let me repeat that. You say you've meditated, but you're wanting help to get further along?
No one's ever taught me, sat with me and done it. Taught, it might be different.
Yeah. Well, there are opportunities to do that. So maybe you should look for them. Thursday night here is one, but there are other places as well.
I mean, I've been joining Eric on Thursdays pretty regularly now for some time. And I can tell you I'm not fixed. But I can honestly tell you I don't get as angry. And so it's been a positive exercise for me to do what has been difficult many times in my past, which is to get myself out of the way.
Hi, Barb. Recently, an event in my life has shown me my ignorance. We had, on a small but very real scale, a home invasion by someone I thought was a friend, who came into our home violently. And I shed everything I thought I knew. And I went back to that place of survival. And unfortunately, that incurred a lot of anger on my part. Because when you're frightened, you get angry. So your words today are very much needed and much appreciated. And I'm so glad to be with this conversation in this group that I can have. I can say something like this. Thank you.
You're welcome. So those emotional states that happen naturally for us humans are welcome. Those are the phone ringing. That is yourself trying to get yourself to pay attention to something that's important. And so in this tradition, the way I work with it, it's not about suppressing or repressing or oppressing these feelings. It's about welcoming them in and trying to understand what is the information that I'm trying to tell myself here. What is it I'm afraid to know, but I'm experiencing anyway? And to lean into that body wisdom and to lean into that heart-led intelligence and eventually understand it and transmute it and transform it. But the first step is to recognize that it's there and admit to what's true. Thank you very much. Well, if we're all done, stump the chump. And I'd like to conclude with a little more meditation. And so think about how that first round of meditation went and how long were you actually able to sit and not think about anything. Did you make it past 5 seconds? Past 3 minutes? Hard to say. And so one of my favorite guys is Rumi. And he wrote a poem a long time ago, "Come, yet again come, worshiper, wanderer, lover of leavings." It's actually in our hymnal. There's a song that has those words. Ours is not a caravan of despair, come, yet again come. Those are actually meditation instructions. Come back again, come back again, come back again. Oh, you're thinking? That's all right, come back again. No shame, no blame, no judgment. When you notice it, smile. And it's like Al likes to say, it's another leaf on the stream. Just watch that leaf floating downstream. Don't try to grab onto it. Notice that you're noticing. And then let it drift away again. And when you make it to the 1 minute mark, eventually you can make it to the 3 minute mark. And then to the 20 minute mark. And in some ways, it's like any exercise program or routine. It seems difficult and confusing. And I feel clumsy at first when I start. But the more often you sit down and practice, the more familiar you'll become with it, and in many ways, the easier it will get. And when that next emotion bubbles up, when that next leaf on the stream shows up, you can ask it, so what is it you want me to know? Why is this important to be feeling? And then you can smile and say, okay. And then let go of it. Say, I'll deal with that later. Not right now. In this tradition, I encourage people to sit with their eyes open instead of eyes closed. Again, as a way of becoming more present rather than a way of leaving and checking out. Some people like to use a mantra, a word to recite. Pick a word. There are lots of them. I don't think there's anything magical about any one particular word. Focus on something with your open eyes. You could focus on a candle or the smoke from the incense or a picture of your favorite vacation spot. Again, it's not that important in the beginning. It's not important at all whether you have a mantra or whether you have a mandala or anything else to focus on. What I often encourage people to do is start with their breath, because no matter where you go, it follows you. And notice how your stomach is moving in and out. Maybe how your lungs are opening and closing as you breathe. Or if you can, notice how the air feels as it moves in and out across the edges of your nostrils. It's actually just make busy work for your brain, which is going to start to put together a laundry list of what else you should be doing if you don't give it something to do. So pick something. Find a speck of dust on the carpet or the back of the person in front of you. And at the fourth ring of the bell, I encourage you to sit quietly and silently, unmoving, unfazed, rooted, embracing the equanimity and the wisdom that lives inside you already.
as we extinguish this flame, let us go our separate ways, knowing not the answer to all things, yet seeking always the answer to one more thing than we know. Let us be searchers with our fellow men and women, adventurers in ways untrod, holding high the hope of discovery, and sharing that hope in whatever discovery may come with others.
Some years ago, Daio Kokushi wrote a description of this, which he called An Zen. There is a reality prior to the heavens and earth, and indeed it has no form, much less a name. Eyes fail to see it. It has no voice for ears to detect. To call it mind or Buddha violates its nature, for it then becomes like a visionary flower in the air. It is not mind, nor is it Buddha. It's absolutely quiet and yet illuminating in a mysterious sort of a way. It allows itself to be perceived only by the clear eye and open heart. It is Dharma, clearly beyond form and sound. It is Tao, having nothing to do with words. And wishing to entice the blind, the Buddha has playfully let words escape his golden mouth, and heaven and earth have ever since been filled with entangling briars. All my good worthy friends gathered here, if you desire to listen to the thunderous voice of the Dharma, exhaust your words and empty your thoughts, for only then may you come to recognize the one essence.